Hey, this is Andy Narricott, and welcome to episode 36 of the Finding Impact podcast.
FindingImpact.com. FindingImpact.com. Helping you scale your social business.
Hey, everyone. This is Andy Narricott, and this is the podcast for social entrepreneurs in social enterprise, government, charity, large corporations, basically anyone hustling hard to create lasting social impact in the world. Today, I'm interviewing Ken Giroghi of Cellulant. Ken is an inspiring story of making it in Africa. He's a young, driven businessman in Kenya who's breaking stereotypes about doing business here. You know, the stereotypes about bribery and corruption. It's all part and parcel of doing business here. Well, get a load of this story. It's going to blow you away. Ken's an ordinary bright dude in Kenya who's worked hard and created a multi-million dollar mobile-enabled business that has, without a doubt, connected so many Africans to markets today. Anyway, so listen on to hear this interview with one of Africa's, I believe, one of Africa's living legends. But my big question going into this episode or this interview was, against all the barriers and roadblocks that businesses face here, is it true that you can build a multi-million dollar business with simple grit and determination? But from what I've heard and read, that's exactly what Ken seems to have done with his co-founder. So I'm going to go and check it out and find out more and join me on that interview. But before we go into the show, I'd like to thank you for being here. My goal is to help you scale your social impact. So in order to help me do that, I need to hear from you. So what are you struggling with right now? What guests would you like me to get on the show to help you through that struggle? Drop me a quick email at andy@findingimpact.com and I'll get right back to you. Or tweet me up at andy@narricott on Twitter. Okay, let's get into it. Ladies and gents, this is Ken Giroghi. Hey everyone, I'm here with Ken Giroghi of Cellulant, a fellow Nairobian. I'm very pleased to have him on the show. He was highly recommended by Christy Peacock of one of the earlier ones. And yeah, Ken, welcome onto the show.
Sure. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
Pleasure. Well, thank you for inviting me into your office. I can tell everyone what I'm seeing here is this beautiful expanse of some trees and various bits and pieces. But it's thank you. And the coffee's good as well. So I'm happy.
Most welcome.
So Ken, I mean, perhaps you could tell us, take us on your journey from early days and of Cellulant and how things have evolved.
Okay. So interesting. So my journey as an entrepreneur started actually about 19 years ago or thereabouts. So started my first business in 1998. I was a web development firm called Three Mice. This was very early days of internet. So we built a small firm that became relatively well known for building great e-commerce platforms and some of the first e-commerce platforms in the region. So we ran that for a couple of years. In the early 2000, we sold that to Africa Online, who was the largest ISP at that time. And then coincided with a period where there was a sort of a huge traction in the mobile industry. One of our customers at Three Mice happened to be Safaricom. And when I started marking around the business to try and understand the business, I noticed this very rapid rise of subscriber numbers. I mean, to compare, at the time we used to talk about 15,000 dial-up connections in the country. And so there was this huge mobile operator where, you know, basically they were adding hundreds of thousands of customers in a month. So I think it hit me. That was my first sort of turning point, because it hit me like an epiphany that maybe this thing that we call the internet will sort of make its way to mobile in one form or another. And you could say that at that point, the idea of building a mobile a business in the mobile sector was born. And so shortly thereafter, we ran into each other with my co-founder at Cellulant, a guy called Bolaji. He was an energetic, very smart Nigerian guy who was working in Nairobi for a World Bank-funded project called African Virtual University. And we started bouncing around ideas and just getting to know each other and that sort of thing. And we spend about 4 hours every day talking about all kinds of subjects. And I think just a couple of things always kept nagging at us. I think one of them was that when looking around, you could find Africans, Nigerians, Kenyans, all kinds of Africans doing all kinds of nice things globally and for global institutions. But when you looked around, you couldn't find sort of African enterprises that had grown to really become highly institutionalized, cross-border, and of a certain scale. And it was always, we always asked ourselves why. You know, there didn't seem to be a good reason. Yes, of course, the continent had all kinds of challenges. Yes, the operating environment was difficult. But as we always said with Bolaji, you know, you play the game and win the game with the cards you're dealt.
Mm.
And so I think this idea of sort of building a world-class, large, pan-African business founded in Africa by Africans became really a sort of solid idea in our minds. Mm. So I think through this sort of journey of 4 hours of a coffee and that sort of thing, one day we sort of sketched this concept on a serviette and called it Cellulant. And it was a concept of a billion-dollar, world-class, mobile-based company that also was founded on certain values. I think as young people sort of grew from fairly, I wouldn't say disadvantaged backgrounds, but sort of money poor backgrounds, we were always driven by this idea that you could actually create wealth by running a values-driven business. So no corruption, no bribing, none of that stuff. Open business, hiring young people, challenging them to be their best. And this is essentially the idea for what Cellulant is today. So it's, of course, over time, it evolved into a mobile payments company, but driven by the same values. I mean, we want to build a billion-dollar business because, at $10 million, and maybe there could be some debate as to whether you can really create wealth without corruption. Maybe at $100 million might be some debate, but at $1 billion, there's no contest as to whether these values actually work on this continent. And so we sort of went out from this serviette and sort of went out into the market to try and sort of build this business. We eventually came into the market in 2004. We started off as a music business, actually. So selling ringtones and music tracks for $1 to consumers in Kenya and Nigeria. So it was a very simple business. We published a catalog of sort of all the top hot songs in the country. The popular stuff at the time was local vernacular, mainly gospel music. Consumers bought it, these songs at $1, paid through their phone top-up, and we took a cut out of the phone top-up charged from the operator, and that's it. And in 4 years, we built a $4.5 million business, which was very profitable doing this sort of stuff. So the first 2 to 3 years were very difficult. I mean, basically, these were years where we were trying to bootstrap the business. It was generally an expensive business to set up. You needed infrastructure, you needed good people very early. We knew we weren't going to build a billion-dollar business with secondary people, so you always wanted very good people, but you couldn't afford them. And we worked very hard to try and get these people. If you wanted infrastructure, you wanted the best infrastructure and that sort of thing. So it was very difficult the first 2 to 3 years trying to bootstrap the business. We sold everything that we could sell, maxed out every card that we could, and borrowed from everybody that you could to sort of build the business. So I would say 70% of our time was actually spent sort of running this funding operation.
Raising the money.
Yeah. And convincing staff who are generally world-class and in demand to keep working and keep taking pressure, sometimes 2 months, 3 months, 4 months without salary.
Wow.
So that was an extraordinary amount of time. And then somewhere in the third year, you know, a lot of the sort of dots came together.
Yeah.
The business started to grow fairly rapidly, got cash flow positive. We started to generate steady cash flow. And all of a sudden, you know, there's all this 70% of time and effort was no longer there. So a lot of that bandwidth, Balaji and I started thinking to then saying, okay, we know that there's a business here, no question about it. At that time, we had served, I think, about 8 million unique customers in Kenya and Nigeria. And it had become very clear that you could do simple extrapolation into a billion-dollar business by saying, look, I mean, you know, if we extrapolate, it's 8 million customers, 100 million customers, who, and each of them would buy a truck a month. Mm. With 100 by one, that would be $100 billion business right there. So it became, so you could say that that sort of first form of our mission, 100 by one, which still continues to guide our growth today, sort of crystallized around that time. And then we started to think hard about, and that became a very simple sort of true north, you know, because then you'd ask yourself, so what do we need to do to get to 100 million customers? What do we need to do to continue to make a dollar per customer per month? And this focus of sort of trying to figure out this sort of big strategic sort of questions, the $100 million was much easier problem because we'd already served about 8 million customers. You could say, well, you know, if we extrapolate this business to 13, 14, 20 countries, you could make up that number. $1 was a little bit more tricky because at the time, the mobile operator took, so we charged a dollar. The mobile operator kept 80 cents. We kept 20 cents. So that was a little bit more nuanced because you couldn't see a situation in which somebody would buy five trucks a month. So what we decided to do them, as we thought hard about this problem, we said, hang on, then maybe that's a problem to solve, and maybe we need to build an alternative payment platform for this problem. And because I'd worked in e-commerce for a while, it was easy to then conceptually see that maybe we could actually build a payment platform where the customer, instead of paying using their top-up, could charge their bank account for a dollar. And so we started talking to a lot of banks at the time.
So to bypass the
telco. To bypass the telco. We started talking to a lot of banks, and I started knocking. This was before M-Pesa launched. I think it was about a year before M-Pesa launched, and banks thought we were crazy. Banks would tell us, I mean, guys, get serious. Who on earth would trust a financial transaction through a mobile phone? It'll never happen. And you know, and so we just kept, you know, drumming this vision of mobile services and things like that. And then in 2007, M-Pesa launched in the market. So they went to pilot in 2006. It was below the radar. They launched in March of 2007. And by end of that year, they crossed a million customer mark and hit the tipping point.
Yeah.
And the argument was settled. And because we had, so we hadn't signed up any banks at that time.
Yeah.
But we had a lot of name recognition. So people couldn't remember what we were called. People would call us Cellulite or something like that. So, but we had those Cellulite crazy guys who were talking about this mobile payment stuff. And so when M-Pesa numbers started to show up in the media, most of these banks called us in. And then what happened is within a very short time, we signed a lot of the large banks in the country. We just, it's a case of sort of being in the right place at the right time. And this sort of launched what I would say was phase two of our business, where we started off as a music business and moved on to become a payments business. And then it became apparently clear from us that maybe that if we could actually build this payment platform for our music business, that payment platform could actually serve other people with similar needs. And maybe that was the business to be in.
Go upstream.
And that's how the business became a payments business. And then we went through this sort of rapid journey of growth from first transforming from music business to a business selling payment solutions to the banks. Signed up a large chunk of the multinational banks. So today we serve all of the multinational banks and basically scaled out to the business we are today. So and in that process then scaled out to 13 countries and to be ideally one of the leading payment companies in the continent. So we are of course, very far from vision, far from mission. We are on vision, but far from mission.
Yeah, you're close to 100 billion, right?
Not quite, actually. I think it's maybe another 7 to 10 years or so. If we continue to grow at the rate last year into this year, we have grown quite substantially. So if we sustain that rate of growth, then it's a 7 to 8 year journey. and of course, the journey has not been without its challenges. The payment space is fairly new. So you're having to solve for problems that typically you wouldn't need to in other regions. But, you know, I think Balaji and I were mentally prepared to succeed at against all odds, as I like to say. And so the journey, to be quite honest, took much, much longer than we thought. I think Balaji and I thought we would get to mission by 2015, 2016.
Wow.
More 2022 thing.
Yeah.
So, of course, it's been a 13-year journey. So, as an entrepreneur and a human being, we've gone through, for me, I think about one or two moments of serious doubt. And where, you know, in the sort of phase of that doubt, it could have gone anywhere. I could have come out of that phase with saying that, look, I think I've done enough now. Let me go and try and do something else.
And
that's just the nature of the journey. Of course, the business had transformed from a two-month Soviet sort of concept to 240 people. That growth of people has also been a challenge in itself, because then it challenges you to grow, to manage differently. I mean, you manage a five-man team very differently from a 20-man team, from a 240-man team. I think my sweet spot was 20.
Really? As a CEO?
As a personality, right?
Okay, yeah.
My sweet spot was 20. Even though at 20, it was still crazy, because everybody sort of reported to me. This is, I think, sometime back in 2008. And then you still had a lot of control over everything.
Yeah.
So Balaji and I are sort of, we are generally unreasonable about timelines. We just typically, there's always something that feels right about how long things should take.
Mm-hmm.
And it's always a third what everybody thinks is reasonable. We tend to stretch goals by twice or three times. It's just nature.
Mm.
So it felt nice when you had 20 people reporting to you, and you could stretch the goals that you liked.
Mm.
As the business has grown, I think it's been a significant learning curve for me to sort of create these two layers of management.
Yeah.
And sometimes accept that deadlines won't be done as quickly as I want them.
Mm.
And once in a while, balls will drop, and it's okay. And you have to. You have to resist the temptation of sort of grabbing the ball and running with it yourself. It's no longer practical with teams all over the place.
Yeah.
But also it's, so that has, for me, has been extremely difficult.
So that was Ken. So I cut that a bit short there, because I want to save the second half of that for next week. Such a nice guy. So welcoming when I went to visit him. And thank you to Ken and his wonderful team. But what did I learn in that episode? I learned that Ken's unfair advantage, which anyone can have, is the willingness to outwork anyone, to have more grit and determination than anyone, to not give in to the blockages in the road, but to actually push through them and stick to the vision. And that's another thing. The vision came first. That's the whole, start with why thing, the TED Talk by Simon Sinek. That's what Ken started with. He and his co-founder sat for hours, 4 hours a day over coffee every day, figuring out what was their why. Why were they going into this? And that was before any business came. And with that clarity, their true north, the barriers that would block their way further down the line and cause them to rethink and enter into doubt, self-doubt, they could overcome all of the challenges. So remember to be clear on your why. Get your vision crystal clear before you start. Or if you've started, stop now. Stop what you're doing and invest the time in that. Because without it, What will you call on when everything is telling you to give up? But make sure you drop me an email, andy@findingimpact.com, to let me know what you think, give me some ideas for another show, or pitch me your story. I'd love to feature someone's early days or some other anyone else's story on this Finding Impact, if there's something that we can all learn from. But make sure you tune in next week for the second part of my interview with Ken, when he'll be telling us about some of the darker times of his journey, when he nearly gave it all up, and what he pulled on and to get through it, and how did he pull through it. So make sure you tune in for that. And finally, today's quote comes from Barbara Hall, author and TV producer, who said, "The path to our destination is not always a straight one. We go down the wrong road, we get lost, we turn back. Maybe it doesn't matter which road we embark on. Maybe what matters is that we just embark." Fantastic. Thanks very much, everyone. Thank you all for listening. Have a great week, and I'll see you next Wednesday.
FindingImpact.com. Helping you scale your social business.